All right, guys, we're going to go ahead and get started. People are still trickling in here from lunch. My name is Chris Munical. I've met some of you. I don't know if I met all of you. I'm the marketing director here, and I'm here to introduce our speaker today, Mark Joseph, who is a Bile alumni. And he founded BullyPulpit.com, and he writes on FoxNews.com. And he has also worked on several high-profile movies, such as Chronicles of Narnia. And today he's here to address bridging the gap between entertainment industry and God blogging.
Thanks. I'm going to go old school and use an actual microphone in my hands. It's great to be here with you all. I know some of you, I've gotten to know some of you, and it's a lot of fun to be here for me. Last week, I work out at the same gym as John Mark Reynolds. You all know John Mark Reynolds, right? The guru. So we work out at the same gym, and he came up to me, and I said, I've got a problem, John Mark. I have to write a book on Sarah Palin in 4 days. I don't think I can make it to GodBlogCon this year. He said, keep writing, you'll make it. And he was right. I had a conversation with my book agent about 10 days ago, and he said, what's the fastest you've written a book before? And I said, well, I wrote this one book in 3 weeks, which is just crazy. He said, how about 7 days? And I thought he was absolutely insane, but when you put your mind to something, you can actually do it. So I have a Sarah Palin book. I know every useless fact and useful fact about Sarah Palin, so if you have any questions later, I know almost too much about her. I have to tell a funny story on my friend Michael Levine, who is not here. This is not going to be on the podcast, is it? Well, if it is, that's okay. Michael is a famous Hollywood publicist. He's represented everybody from, Michael Jackson to Demi Moore to you name it. He's represented them. About 10 years ago, he called me up, and he said, Mark, what do you think about the World Wide Web? You think it's here to stay? And I said, yeah, Michael, I think the Internet's going to be around. He says, well, because I don't think so. I think it's going to be a fad that's going to go away. Well, about 2 years later, he wrote a book called Guerrilla. He had written a book called Guerrilla PR. That's his famous book. He wrote Guerrilla PR Wired 2 years later when he decided the World Wide Web was here to stay. So we never know the future, but I think we can all agree that the web is here to stay, and Michael was wrong on that. I spoke at the God Blog convention 3 years ago, and it was a very odd experience because people were blogging while I was talking. But if you're doing it now, it's okay because I'm totally used to it. But the first time I experienced that, I was like, could you wait till I'm done before you trash my talk? But it was good. So for those of you who are doing it, go for it. Just be kind. I have 1 foot in the old world and 1 foot in the new world in the sense that I write a column for FoxNews.com and I also blog for the Huffington Post. So I'm getting to experience right now both of those, and they're totally different dynamics, as you can imagine. And I experienced this recently at the Saddleback non-debate between McCain and Obama. I'm in the very back with all the journalists, and you know I'm trying to blog as I'm hearing, but I don't really know exactly what I'm seeing. I don't know if my impressions are correct or if I heard something wrong. And you know, normally I have a chance to digest the information and go back home and think about it and write a column, but with blogging, it's so immediate. My sense was that Obama wasn't doing very well that day because he just seemed a little nervous, and I felt like Rick Warren was like a school teacher kind of talking to a student. That was my sense when I was there, but I didn't know. I mean, was I misinterpreting it? And I think after I left the hall and I talked to others, that was the sense that McCain had done very well there. And Obama had not been at his best. But for instance, when McCain said, Obama said that it was above his pay grade about abortion, at the time, it didn't strike me as flippant as I felt it was later. And again, this is the challenge of blogging versus writing books and writing columns. You're just not quite sure if your instincts are correct. So that was an interesting experience. Also, the Secret Service threw me out, which is another interesting experience. No respect for bloggers, you know. They threw me out, and I came back in, and they let me in, and they had a credential this and credential that. But so we're kind of at the bottom of the media food chain still. It's like ABC News, CBS, and then the little bloggers, you know, who they can kick out and bring back in whenever they feel like it. I do write for, I have two bosses, obviously, Rupert Murdoch, who I've never met, but God bless him, He sends me a nice check whenever I write. Arianna Huffington, again, these are not exactly on the same political and philosophical playing fields, but it's very interesting, and I enjoy it. Arianna's been great. I email her whenever I have a question or a comment. She's never in any way, you know, said I can't write about something or censored me in any way. In fact, she'll write and suggest a topic. During the Chronicles of Narnia, she wanted me to write about that. I said I can't because I work on the movie. So it's great to have that input. You know, one other difference between blogging and columns for me is that the blogging is just like the ultimate, you know, in immediate satisfaction. I write something in 15 seconds, it's there, and the whole world can read it, whoever reads that site. Columns, again, it's a process. You know, I'll go to my Fox News editor and say, what about this topic? And he'll say, no, that's stupid. Try another one. Or he'll say, great, send me a first draft. So 3 days later, I send him a first draft. There's just this process that goes on, and it's totally different. One takes a week, 2 weeks, 10 days. One is 20 seconds. I do love the columns. I like the input from an editor. It's really helpful to me, actually. Whereas with my blogging, you know, I'm not quite sure, did I say something wrong? Am I going to offend anybody? Which I obviously do. But that process of an editor is something that I really enjoy. So again, I have kind of one foot back in the old world and one foot in the new world. But to give you one example, I was working on a column on Obama, and I had mentioned that he's the most liberal candidate that has ever run in history on this for the Democrats. My editor at Fox News said, prove it. So I went and researched it, and I went through the voting records of George McGovern and John Kerry, and I found out that he was the most liberal member, and my editor said, okay, he bought it. It was just this give and take process that goes on that wouldn't have been there if I was blogging. I want to talk a bit later about this site that I've been developing called bullypulpit.com. I had to buy the domain name for $2,000 from a squatter, so if any of you are squatting, there's a reward in it. The title of the talk is The Role of God Bloggers in the Entertainment Business, but I also want to digress a little bit about politics and media and a few other things like that along the way. I'm not sure what happens to the old phrase, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, because you're bloggers, so of course it's not going to stay in Vegas. So I'm very mindful that anything I say could pop up years later somewhere, like with Sarah Palin and this video that's showing up of her in church. So, but I do want to say one thing about Vegas. I brought my wife and four children with me. I figure I can't get into any trouble if they're with me. So they're back at the hotel right now doing their homeschooling, and we're having a fun time just to keep Dad out of trouble. This is the only shirt that I have to wear today because my other shirt is on the freeway somewhere between L.A. and Las Vegas. True story. We're driving along. My two-year-old says, Daddy, throw up. That's not a good sign when you're a kid. And your two-year-old says she needs to throw up. So we opened the windows, and my shirt was hanging, and out it went onto the freeway. One of my kids said, Daddy, maybe there's like a homeless guy that needed your shirt, and that's why God arranged for it. So I'm glad she's thinking in these kind of spiritual terms already. But so if you see me in the same shirt today and tomorrow, that's why. I really did have two prepared. You know, I just think we're living in an amazing, amazing age, that you guys, especially you guys under the age of 30 or 20 or whatever you are, you know, can kind of take for granted. I worked for 4.5 years at Walden Media, and one of my jobs was I would come across every film, good and bad, that had been made, many times by well-meaning Christians. And invariably, they would come to me and give me a film, a DVD, and say, you know, God told me to make this film. Okay, I'm not going to, you know, make fun of that. And it cost like $4 million or $3 million or in one case, $17 million. But the funny thing was that God had never told them about distribution. He had just told them to make it. And I started a joke that God is only in the business of inspiring production and not distribution. Because, and again, these are well-meaning people, but they had no plan for what to do after the film was made. They ranged from Facing the Giants, which came to us early on a long time ago, to a film on Martin Luther just called Luther, which is an amazing, I mean, a very well-done film that was made with funds from the Lutheran Pension Fund. But again, the distribution is the problem. In the movie world, it's still a problem. But think about you guys and what you do. The distribution problem is solved. You have no more excuses. you have don't have the excuses that we have in film or music, TV to some extent as well, but you have distribution worldwide for whatever you want to do. And it's easy to take that for granted, but that is a huge, huge thing. Matt Drudge, let's just get the 800-pound gorilla off the table at this moment. Matt Drudge controls the universe. I mean, has this much power ever been in the hands of one man in history? I think he's more powerful than Rupert Murdoch or than Oprah or anybody, because he gets up in the morning. He lives in Miami. He's got an apartment overlooking a penthouse, whatever, overlooking the ocean, I think it is. And he gets up in his pajamas or whatever he's wearing, and he decides what the news is that day. I mean, all the producers in America go to his site and say, what should we cover today? It's an amazing, amazing phenomenon that people don't really write about. And this is just one guy. He has no corporation behind him. He could probably sell that site for gazillions of dollars. It's just him and his partner, Andrew Breitbart, in Los Angeles. And that's a great example of what any one of you could do in this audience if you found the right secret sauce like Drudge has found. So the distribution problem is solved. Now it's really in each of our courts to decide what to do with it. I give you an example of the power of Drudge. The other day, Oprah, if you recall, decided she wasn't going to have Sarah Palin on the show, which is just shocking, obviously. You know, why wouldn't she have a show on this female candidate who's running for office? Shocking. Drudge gives the headline, you know, whatever it is, Oprah won't have Sarah Palin on. Oprah is forced to respond in a couple hours' time, you know, saying, no, I'm going to have her on, but just after the election. Well, again, this is we think of Oprah as the most powerful person in media. She's forced by Drudge to respond that day. It happens every day. If he puts a story up on McCain or Obama, and it's in any way something that requires a response, they are on it like that. So again, that much power focused in one person. I know Matt very tangentially. I met him maybe 12 years ago in Hollywood. He's a guy who started in an apartment in Hollywood. He worked in the CBS gift shop, and he would hear all these great rumors and stuff, and so he started posting these on his little Usenet back in 96, I think it was, and slowly built up his site. At first, as you know, he's kind of a Luddite. It's just, you know, text. Everyone's kind of moving along in the world and doing video, and he's just got his little links up there. But he did start putting ads on. The kind of money that they make on that site, you know, it's an ad can go for $10,000, and that's one ad times think of all the ads that are on there. So the point is, you guys have the potential to be a Matt Drudge. Matt Drudge is a typical guy with great instincts, and his distribution problem is solved, and yours is too. One thing that I'm constantly reminded of for my sites is to give people a reason to come. You know, it's not enough that you're out there. What is the takeaway value? For me, going to Drudge or the Huffington Post, it brings me value. I come away knowing, having more knowledge, being more aware of things. And so as you guys have your sites, I think that's an important, important thing. The other thing is, as God bloggers, you know, I think the challenge that I think all Christians face and all people of faith face, even if you're not a Christian, as a person of deep faith, is how do you make your ideas and topics relevant to people that don't agree with you? Obviously, when I write for the Huffington Post or for Fox News, I'm writing for people that don't agree with me. It's just a given. For instance, with more, and I get, you know, I tend to get hate mail from all kinds of people. I used to post for a site called townhall.com, and you know, I'd get 10, 15, 20 like hate messages from people accusing me of whatever. The Huffington Post is a challenge because they come up right away. But the challenge is to learn to get people to think in new ways. The Huffington Post reader tends to be a little more liberal. That may be an understatement. You all are laughing. So when I write about abortion, I'm writing about it in a unique way that doesn't trigger the obvious reactions. To give you one example, I wrote about how this is actually a curious phenomenon, but abortion has had a devastating consequence for the Democratic Party. There's a sociologist with the Wall Street Journal who went back and analyzed who has been aborted over the last 40 years, whatever it is, 73, so 35, 36 years. And he did the analysis by finding out who is having the abortions, Republican versus Democrat. And Democrats tend to have more abortions than Republicans, although not by much, you'd be surprised. And then he extrapolates that 90% of the time, you tend to follow the voting patterns of your parents. Then he goes state by state, and he finds out that had Roe versus Wade never happened, Al Gore would be president today. He would have won six states that were actually Bush states. So this is the way that I framed my conversation on abortion. And I had a little joke at the end. I said, if I were Howard Dean, the chairman of the Democratic Party, I would offer a $500 check to every Democratic couple who brings a child to term. Well, this got some laughs, but it actually didn't get a lot of hate mail because I think people were thinking. And it was incumbent on me to try to raise an issue in a fresh and new way for an audience that was used to kind of knee-jerk, you know, don't kill your baby kind of stuff. And I think it's the same for a more conservative audience. It's still bringing things in a different light and challenging. And the reason I mention that is I think our tendency, the tendency of people of faith and particularly of Christians is to say, okay, I'm just going to write for fellow believers. And it's easier. It takes less effort. It takes less thought. But ultimately, it's not really what we're put on the planet for to do that exclusively. My father is a missionary. He's in a country that has almost no Christians. His whole life is about speaking to people who disagree with him. And so how does he do that? He comes up with new ways to talk about, to tell the same old story. I wrote a book in 99 and in 2003 that was really about the Christian music business and the mistakes that the Christian music business made in not being available for the world. When this group got together in the mid to late 70s and started contemporary Christian music, the problem is that when you brand yourself that way, what you communicate to non-Christians is this is not for you, this is for us. And I often use the example, if you moved to a town and you heard there was a radio station, their tagline was, we play today's hottest Jewish hits, you know, what would you think? Would you think, A, that's for me, you know, you're not Jewish, that's for me, I can't wait to hear that station. Or would you think, that's so great, I'm so glad that the Jews have their own station, that's really cool. Probably the latter, if they're communicating to you that this is not for you unless you're Jewish. And that's what I think the mistake that a lot of Christians have made over the years is by the way we title and brand and we use Christian as kind of a little bit of a weapon to bat people away. If you're not Christian, this is not for you. And that was the mistake that I found with a lot of the Christian industry. I have some friends in a band called POD. They're based out of San Diego. And people would hear them go to a concert or hear about them, and they would go to the record store, the CD store, and they would go to the clerk and say, I can't find POD. You know, why aren't they in the P section? And the clerk would say, well, they're in the gospel section in the back. Well, this is not the gospel quartet. You know, this is not the Bill Gaither trio. This is guys with dreadlocks, you know, and who are singing about their faith in God. And the people would just leave. They would not go to the gospel section. It's just not their culture. It's not, that's their mom or their grandma's culture. It's not who they're from. So again, the destructive tendency that we have, that the Christian community has, is to use this labeling to keep people away. And I think what I'm so encouraged about, even this conference, I mean, again, this is normal to you guys, but the fact that John Mark and the leadership have set this up at this conference is huge. It's not what happens in music and books. In the case of books, Christians involved in books gather at the CBA convention, far apart from the ABA convention, which is the normal mainstream book-selling convention. In the case of music, the Gospel Music Association gathers in Nashville, thousands of miles away from the there's a number of music conferences, but the Billboard conference or South by Southwest. So the physical proximity of this location here is huge. You know, you're with all the other bloggers. You're here and you're part of the debate. They can come in here. You can go to them. I just had lunch with somebody who is not part of the God Blog Con, but is part of here. So this is huge. And I think this is a chance to not make the same mistakes that were made in other genres. You know, give us enough time, we may try to come up with a Christian internet. Can you imagine? I mean, can we have a safe alternative for the family? I mean, it's not unthinkable. It's what happened in a lot of other genres. It's sort of like in politics, if you could imagine that, let's say you know, people got so disgusted with politics, they said, let's form separate congresses in each state. We'll have a Christian Congress, and we'll pass all the laws we want to. So we'll have an alternative Christian Congress in California and Nevada, and we'll outlaw abortion. It won't actually change the laws, but we'll feel good about it, and we'll have an alternative universe. It's kind of what we've done in music and TV and film. So when movies got really, or when music got really bad, let's say Two Live Crew came along in 1990, and the Christian subculture's response was, well, we'll have DC Talk over here. Now, Two Live Crew will be corrupting our culture and our children, but we'll have an alternative universe over here. And again, it just doesn't make sense if our goal is really to impact people's lives. So all that to say that the start that's happening here with GodBlogCon over the last 3 or 4 years is really, really amazing. I always come back to Mars Hill. This is overused, but it's still relevant, I think. And look at what the Apostle Paul did. He came to Athens, he came to this town, and he used the language of the culture. He knew the history. The references he made clearly indicated that he had studied the culture. He knew the terms to use. And he didn't even go to a synagogue. Oh, there wasn't a synagogue, but he didn't go to necessarily a specific place and gather like-minded people. He went to the center of town where these religious discussions happened, and he was there, and he found the applicable terminology. And I think that just has to be our model. I want to transition a little bit to talking about the reach, and then I'll get into some of the specifics of entertainment. But when you think of the reach of the internet, it's going to cause a rethinking of all kinds of things. My parents went to be missionaries in 1951, 54. There was no World Wide Web. There was nothing. There were telegrams, and you know, they took a ship to go to Japan in 1951. There were no airplanes that flew commercially at that time very often. So how does the World Wide Web cause mission agencies to rethink their strategies? I'm not sure that conversation has happened. Maybe it has, but I think it needs to happen more often. There's a story that I love to tell about an Indian pastor who came back to the States, and he was meeting with some American Christian leaders, and they said, you know, how can we help you in the work you're doing in India? And I think they expected him to ask for Bibles or money or, you know, whatever, and all he said was, please stop sending us Baywatch. And that's Baywatch, right? That's kind of innocent, right? That's nothing compared to the other stuff that Hollywood produces. But the point is that Baywatch was undoing all that he was trying to do. And that's just swimsuits. Think about the other stuff that Hollywood produces. We produce 90% of the world's porn in the San Fernando Valley of Hollywood. And imagine, you know, just imagine, listen, I'm no fan of Al-Qaeda, and none of you are either, I don't think. But imagine that you're a Muslim father, and when President Bush and others talk about bringing you freedom, you're not thinking about freedom. You're thinking about that your four daughters, I have four daughters. You're thinking about that your kids are going to get Britney and Lindsay as role models. That's pop culture. Forget freedom. Pop culture means your children are functionally destroyed for the next generation because they get American secular pop culture values. Can we understand why they're a little bit fearful of our pop culture? I want to talk as short as possible. I have a lot to get through, but then I want to do lots of Q&A. So I'm going to go through a little bit more, and then please have some questions going so we can spend some time doing Q&A. Part of, I think, the joy of what I get to do and what you guys get to do is to proselytize, not just for your religious beliefs, but for anything you think about, for a political view, for a different view you have. And the word proselytize has become kind of a dirty word today because nobody wants to be proselytized. But really, that's all that is sharing your opinion, trying to convince people of the rightness of your opinion. Any Seinfeld fans in the audience? Okay. Boy, that hand went up so quick. You must be a big fan. I love the episode of Seinfeld where George... George and Elaine are both proselytized. Or actually, Elaine isn't and George is. Elaine goes to her boyfriend's, he's driving her boyfriend's car and he's got Christian rock stations on and she can't figure this out. Why does my boyfriend have Christian rock stations? And he finds out later that she finds out there that he is a Christian and she says, why aren't you trying to tell, you know, get me to tell me about your God and, you know, I'm going to hell. Why don't you tell me, save me? And And Putty, your boyfriend, says, well, it's going to be rough. It's going to be rough to be in hell, but I'm not going to proselytize you. And she's, tell me, half in jest. And then George's boss turns out is a member of a cult that's disguised as like a carpet cleaning business. And he doesn't proselytize him. And George is going, what's the matter with you? Why is nobody trying to convert me to the cult? Am I not proselytize worthy? That's a funny way of getting at it, but I think we should all be in the business of, in a healthy and respectful way, trying to convince each other for our candidate or for our faith or whatever it is. And I joke that we need more people going door to door, like we did in the old days, and not being afraid of it. That's how I learn. That's how I grow as a person. I want to show you my site, but it's not up. Is it coming? Well, we'll give it a chance to warm up. It was there earlier. There we go. I see something now. I want to talk about convergence. How many of you at home have a big screen hooked up to your computer? Okay. So it's starting to happen. I think we're very, very close to that moment when there'll be some new device, probably by Apple, that will allow you to watch. So we at home now, my kids, we'll go to YouTube and we'll watch a video hooked up to the big screen, hooked up to our Mac. So it's still a little clunky, a little sluggish, but it's starting to happen. So what's happening, obviously, you've heard the term a lot, is convergence. And what does that mean? It's really a chance for us to reimagine everything we thought we knew about the way we communicate. And how I've tried to move with this is to have a site that involves books, films, TV, records. We have a speakers bureau, and then we have a Drudge-style news site that people can go to. The name Bully Pulpit obviously comes from Theodore Roosevelt. He was... 100 years ago, bully meant great. It didn't mean being a bully. And a pulpit is a great place to give your opinion. So this is the name that I had been thinking about for years. And, of course, there was a squatter. So I made his day by cutting him a nice check and launched it. We're still very, very, very early in the process. But I want to just go through quickly how we've developed this and what our plans are. The news site... again, what Matt Drudge has taught all of us is the power of aggregating through linking. They're really, Matt Drudge doesn't need to go write any stories. All he has to do is find them. Now, he did break the Monica Lewinsky story. That's how he got his fame. That's how he got his readers. And what has happened is a whole culture of leakers has developed. When he broke the story on Monica Lewinsky, it was because... I think it was Newsweek was not going to go with it. And so the Newsweek guy leaked it to Drudge and said, here. So now all the newspapers are living in terror of if they kill a story, one of the reporters will leak it to Drudge and he'll have an original. So they usually go with stuff now, which is why you're seeing, the John Edwards affair and other stories that in the past wouldn't have been on there. They're going with them for fear of being scooped by Drudge. So imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. So this is what we're doing with the news site. It's fairly similar to what Drudge does. Again, this is not rocket science. We're not reinventing anything. We're just finding the most interesting stories that are happening that day and providing a link to them. For films, now this is an area that, by the way, I want to back up and say one thing about the future. There's a futurist I'm sure you guys are aware of named Alvin Toffler. Alvin wrote a book called Future Shock. The guy who knows everything that's going to happen. I interviewed him once up in the Bay Area, and I asked him, were you ever wrong about anything? And was there something that he said, well, Mark, he said, I have a drawer full of paper underwear. I was sure paper underwear was going to catch on. Of course, it never did. So even Alvin Toffler is wrong about things occasionally. That just doesn't work for me, paper underwear. But the point is that none of us really knows, and it's just, honestly, it's just trial and error. We're all just going to try different things and see if they work. I think about early on when people were trying to charge for web access. It was like $9.99. People still do, by the way. But eventually they realized it wasn't going to, people weren't going to pay, and they wanted free accounts. So Yahoo and Google and different things happen. So the models are constantly adjusting. Google figures out Gmail. Nobody wants to pay for Gmail. We'll do those weird ads that pop up. Isn't that, you guys all have Gmail, isn't that bizarre? Like, I write an email to my friend saying, let's go get pizza, and all of a sudden there's five ads for pizza on the right-hand side of the screen. That is bizarre. Big Brother is definitely watching me now, and his name is Google. So with the films, what I've tried to do, there's kind of a theme, is to have one foot in the old world and one foot in the new. So what we'll do with the film site is we're forming an alliance with a film company, a traditional film company, but we'll also, let me go back, we'll also probably be streaming films at the site. So again, theaters aren't going away, so we'll have a deal with one of the studios where our films will go into theaters, but then simultaneously, maybe some films that are not, that don't have as wide of an appeal, we'll stream them on the site. And again, what does the model look like? I don't know. Will we have commercials? Who knows? It's just simply trial and error. On the music side, that's our first artist. On the third peg there, that's Molly Jensen. Again, both at the same time. We are distributed through Network Music Group, which has Avril Lavigne, Sarah McLachlan, all these amazing artists. So it'll go into physical stores through Network, and then it'll be available digitally on iTunes and everywhere else, and then at our site. Maybe eventually the stores go away completely and we move completely to digital. Who knows? I have no idea. I do know that people still like to hold a product. My 80-year-old mother loves her Bill Gaither DVDs. She loves to hold them in her hands. She's not going to download. And I think that's probably still true for maybe people that are 50, 60. So there's a whole generation of people that still want to access in the traditional way. So we meet the consumer's demands and we do both. By the way, Molly's CD is out in March, and she is, her song is in the first episode of Knight Rider. Knight Rider is coming back to TV, for those of you who are around in the 80s and love David Hasselhoff. I see one right there. So Molly's song will be in the new Knight Rider show. But thinking about that, and again, the focus, the thought today has kind of changed. Thinking about that, the music has totally changed. You know, I have... some friends in a band called Switchfoot, and people come up to Switchfoot with their burned copy of their CD and ask for an autograph on their burned copy. It's like, are you crazy? Yeah, and they sign it, but you know, I'm sure they're thinking, like, you know, first of all, you just stole $12 from me, and now you want me to sign it. But the point is, look, I'm not one who condemns Napster and downloading, because it's market pressure. The CDs got so expensive, they were $17. People said, fine, I'll go download. They will pay for a physical CD or for the songs if the price is reasonable. So the key is to be responsive to the market and not be so caught up in set prices or set whatever. Books, this is an area that we will get into soon, and maybe it's you know, Kindle, maybe it's downloading, maybe it's a physical copy, who knows. But we'll set up a traditional alliance with the publisher and then have a non-traditional direct to web version as well. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. She asked if it was for new content. Sorry, you're not mic'd. So, yeah, it's for new content. Okay, good. She's not mic'd, but she's loud. That's great. Yeah, we talked about Alvin Toffler. If I could give one theme that comes up in the things that I do a lot, it's often translating for Hollywood what the average American thinks. And I think that you all are probably average Americans. I worked on a little movie called The Passion of the Christ. I actually produced the soundtrack for it, the rock soundtrack, and helped to market it. There were so many crazy stories about that. But one of the funniest was a very high-up Hollywood executive, the president of a very major Hollywood production company, came into Mel's office with us and watched the movie. And remember, this is a secular guy. Might be Jewish, I don't know. But anyway, not somebody who understands that movie very well. Watched it, and afterwards Mel would always say, hey, what do you think of my movie? And this guy said, raised his hand, and he said, well, Mr. Gibson, I don't think anybody will watch this movie in a theater, but you might get some DVD sales out of it. So why don't you put it in the theaters for free, And then that'll be like promotion for the DVD. And I remember just thinking, you're in totally insane to think that this movie is not going to resonate. People were crying around me, and, you know, I got choked up. But that is a typical Hollywood mindset of they're viewing art through their prism, and they don't really know who lives in Arkansas and Kansas and Tennessee and Alabama. They live relatively sheltered lives in Malibu and Santa Monica in the hills. They go to the same parties with each other. They just don't know. It's not that I'm a genius. It's that I have relatives. I have relatives who live in St. Louis and Dallas, and I have friends in Ohio. And if there's one thing that I think all of us will help all of us to succeed and you to succeed in what you're doing is to understand the passions of the average American consumer, and the average American person, period, consumer or not, to try to be in touch with them. If you're a presidential candidate, it helps a lot if you know who lives in America. By the way, I think Barack Obama has a pretty good idea, in spite of the fact that he's fairly liberal. If you noticed, he gave a talk in San Francisco where he talked about how the average American, he used a pejorative saying the guns and being bitter and all that, but he understands, at least he understands, that it's a different folk that live in the country than who was in San Francisco for his audience that day. And there's a great verse in 1 Chronicles 12:32 where it talks about the sons of Issachar, and it says they understood the times and what Israel should do. That's a great guiding verse that I use for my life. If you can understand the passions of the average American, you'll really go far. I was talking earlier with Brett about some of the movies that are produced by the Christian community are not the greatest ever, quality-wise, and yet they're very popular. As I said, my mother loves Bill Gaither videos. Bill Gaither is like one of the best-selling DVDs on Billboard on the DVD charts. And the temptation we all have is to kind of mock that stuff and say, well, that, you know, it's stupid. But it is, you know, the Painter of Lights, you know. Hey, is this Rembrandt? No. But people love that stuff, especially people over a certain age. And so for me, the challenge is always to kind of keep my elitism in check and go, you know what, people really like that. I certainly want to be a part of creating excellent work, but I have to also be realistic and say, in that genre, how can we make that genre really quality and help them to do a better job? I think often about Billy Graham, who used to give a lot of interviews to places like the National Enquirer. And people would say, are you crazy? You know, that's a rag. And he would respond, well, but people read them in the checkout lines. And sure, I could be in Christianity Today or, you know, Charisma. But I want to touch people, the average American, in a checkout counter line in St. Louis, Missouri. And that's why he would give interviews to these very odd publications. So understanding the times, understanding what people's lives are. I have so many stories I could tell about this, but this is the major problem with Hollywood, especially with movies. When Mel made The Passion of the Christ, just to give you a sense of the numbers, the first week, the LA Times predicted that The Passion of the Christ would make $25 million the first 5 days of its run. It made 115, which means there was, 90 million unaccounted for dollars that week that the LA Times, which is the expert at predicting box office, you know, revenue predictions, they don't know where that $90 million came from. Let's say that represents 11 million people, I think. If I'm wrong, somebody will correct me. That's 11 million Americans that Hollywood has no idea who they are. Well, I can tell you who they are. It was my aunt in St. Louis who had never been to a movie in her entire life. She was 74 years old. First time in her life. She hadn't seen Bambi. You know, she hadn't seen anything because she was trained that movie theaters are evil and, you know, what if God came back while you were in the theater? You'd be in trouble. I have another relative, another aunt, who had been, I think she had last been to E.T., I think it was, in 81, 82, something like that. These are the unaccounted for 11 million people that Hollywood keeps missing because they keep making movies that are missing the passions of the average American people, no pun intended. There's so many stories out there that haven't been told, and it's an amazing time when you think about it, because Hollywood, if you haven't noticed, have you guys noticed a lot of 70s sitcoms are coming back as movies? I mean, this means that the idea barrel is empty. You know, there is nothing left. So there's actually a great story of how Bewitched came to be made as a movie. The head of the studio, Amy Pascal, had a meeting. Oh, she called a screenwriter on the phone and said, I need a story for Bewitched by tomorrow at noon because I'm meeting with Nicole Kidman. So this screenwriter came up with a story in 24 hours. That's why it was so stupid, because it took 24 hours to come up with this lame story that a Hollywood studio executive decided to make. There's just a certain... They know that if they make The Bad News Bears or Bewitched, it'll do a certain amount of business just because we're all stupid enough and like, okay, I'll go see that. But nobody really likes it, and it usually doesn't make very much money. So at a time when Hollywood, the idea barrel is empty, the Christian community has all these amazing stories. I mean, the Chronicles of Narnia, the Passion, you know, kind of an old story that's been around, but these stories, J.R.R. Tolkien, these are stories in the Christian basement that have been sitting there for 50, 100, 2,000 years, and finally we're getting around to making them. And it's a great moment in that sense, because one side is empty, one side has this great basement of stories. But it's not enough. It's not enough to just make them. As I told you guys, I would get all these stories, movies that have been made, and no distribution. So the challenge for those of us in Hollywood right now is, how do we convince studios that they will make money on this one? I'm producing a movie on President Reagan, just called Reagan. It's based on two books called God and Ronald Reagan and The Crusader. Now, most of you guys probably don't hate Reagan instinct, you know, at your gut level like people do in the circles I live in. So you might say, well, that might be a good idea. I might watch that movie. You know, it's about his life. When I go into studios, like, they laugh me out. They say, nobody will watch that movie. Are you crazy? You know, and I say back to them, are you crazy? Because people would, I think, the people that I know would line up for blocks to see that movie. You know, one great movie on Reagan's life. And here's the story that I often hear back. I heard this, I won't say which one. One of the studios said, well, we tried that with the CBS movie with, like, Josh Brolin. And I'm going, are you crazy times two? You make an insulting movie, and then you use that as a standard for why nobody would want to watch it. And it makes no sense whatsoever. But the great news is that because they're so out of touch, they haven't thought of doing this kind of a movie. And so it's my job to raise the money independently and then go to a studio with a finished product and say, listen, just put it in the theaters. Leave everything else to us. We'll get the word out to our friends and family across the country, and we'll make it a hit movie. Just put it in the theaters. There was a row. The one time that I felt I had some traction with the studio was when I gave him a mental picture. I said, remember when Reagan died and there was like 9 hours of lines of people going by his coffin? Now, they couldn't see him or shake his hand or touch him. It was like a closed coffin. And there were, I forget how many thousands of people that lined up for 8 and 9 hours just to pass through his ex-presence, his corpse. I mean, imagine what people will do. And I gave him the mental picture of, you know, lines around blocks. And it was like, And kind of, they remembered that picture from Simi Valley, and they kind of thought, yeah, there might be something there. But the larger issue, again, is understand the times, and you may have to even convince people that you understand the times. But remember, you don't have the problems we have in movies. You don't have to fight for distribution. You have distribution. I'm going to say it for the fifth time. You have your distribution. Now you just have to go out and create the exciting stories and that draw people to what you're doing. Being out of touch has devastating consequences. Narnia 2 did about half the business of Narnia 1. I was a part of Narnia 1. I was not too much a part of Narnia 2, just in a very minor way. But I think it was a disaster to have a producer and a director of Narnia who were constantly downplaying the Christian content of Narnia, constantly kind of poo-hooing it, going, oh, well, it's about whatever religion you want it to be about. in the first Narnia, even having Lucy fire an arrow, or Susan, when Lewis explicitly had them not doing so. Anytime you undermine the story, the audience reacts. I mentioned that I have relatives around the country. I listen to them. On the way from here to Las Vegas, we stopped in a diner, and I talked to the waitress. And I said, you know, what do you think about Sarah Palin? And she told me, you know, this is how we all have to keep in touch with people that are outside of our communities, and we can't lose touch with the average person. By the way, she said, I think it's great that she has a daughter and she's standing by her and blah, blah, blah. I didn't ask who she was voting for, but I have a hunch who she's voting for. But again, that helps me. I'm living in the Los Angeles area. I can easily get out of touch. Now I have a better understanding. I have the waitress in the back of my mind, and I understand that now when I think about politics. By the way, to digress on Reagan for a second, the reason that Reagan was so in touch with his audience in 1980 was he had spent the greater part of 10 years touring General Electric plants for GE. He would go from city to city as the kind of the GE spokesperson, speaking at banquets for the GE employees. Well, guess what he's hearing in the 60s and 70s? He's hearing, we're tired of high taxes, my family's going to hell, my kid's on drugs. He wasn't a genius necessarily, although you may think he was. He had acquired this knowledge from all this time spent on the road with average Americans. That's why he was totally in touch with that's why there are things called Reagan Democrats, because they're Democrats that Republicans could never reach before, because Republicans tend to hang out in country clubs. Reagan didn't. He hung out with the GE plant guys in banquets eating chicken every night. Specifically, the role of the God blogger, and then I hope we can do some Q&A in entertainment. I worked on marketing with apologies to Brett. I worked for about 3-4 months helping the Facing the Giants movie get the word out. Now, the caveats are this is a movie made for $100,000 by a church. It looks like a $100,000 movie made by a church. There's no professional actors. It's like if your Aunt Helen and your Uncle Ted and you got together and you had a camera and you said, let's make a movie. That's what it looks like. But the story is there. I mean, the guy has heart. I always said, before this movie got famous, I always said if we can give this guy, like, budget and real actors, he could really do something special. He has the ability to tell a story. But it really wasn't going anywhere. Sony had agreed to pick it up, but they kind of have a condescending attitude toward these faith-based movies. They'll put it in 300 theaters, but they'll put, you know, some ridiculous road trip movie in 2,000, 3,000. It's just the way they treat them. So they put Facing the Giants in 400 theaters, or they were going to. This is in June. As part of the marketing group, I got a call one day that Facing the Giants had gotten a PG rating. And I thought, well, that's kind of strange. Why would it get a PG rating? There's no sex. There's no violence. There's nothing there. Why? And so I had somebody go back and check with the MPAA, which is the Motion Picture Association of America. They do all the ratings. And they came back to us and said there were two reasons. They were for excessive religious content and elevating one religion over another. And I'm like, wow, this is great. And the people on the call said, what are you talking about? I said, well, that's our marketing campaign. We've just had a new rating system installed. So imagine, like, you're a parent and you sit Johnny down and you say, well, I want to warn you about this film. They talk about a deity. Don't be alarmed. You know, it's going to be the same conversation you'd have about sex or drugs. So I contacted Drudge, and they said, if you'll find a reporter to write the story, we'll link to it. So a reporter named Terry Mattingly wrote the story, and at 9 a.m., Drudge linked, and all hell broke loose. Drudge literally created the movie Facing the Giants. The power of his... the next week we were on Good Morning America and the New York Times and Time and Newsweek, all because of a little link provided by the most powerful person in media. And this guy goes on Good Morning America, and he's a director from Albany, Georgia. Perfect, you know, just southern accent. He's like, I don't know, I just made a movie about my life, and these big city slickers are upset with me, and I got a PG rating and loved it. The whole country went to see this movie. What could it be about that was so bad? So that's the kind of thing that I think God bloggers can do. I mean, you don't have the power of Matt Drudge, but you have the ability to highlight the good, maybe ignore the bad, or maybe critique the bad. But the point is, you're bringing it to the attention of the culture. And I think as a community, if you guys could do this, you could really help along projects that are worthwhile. Does that mean I have 20 minutes? To what? 2 minutes. Okay. Now I have 1 minute. Not much time for Q&A. Well, let me stop and do Q&A then for however much time we have. Any questions? Yes. Okay, I'll restate your question for the mic. Right, the question was, why aren't Christians the pace setters? Why do Christians copy what the world is making? Yeah, that's a great question. You know, oddly enough, the WWJD thing, I like that because that was a trendsetter. That was the start. Now the secular world copies that, you know, with WW whatever. That's kind of cool. The fish is kind of cool because the Darwin thing copied the fish. So I always think of those two things as exceptions to the rule because that's something that Christians created, the world responded to, and it's a derivative form. You know, that's a great question. I think if you look at it historically, R&B, gospel, R&B comes from slaves singing to God in the fields. So I don't think it's always been that way. I think that genre of music came from Christian slaves singing out to God, and that became co-opted by others who sang about more worldly things. So you're right. The only original thing I've ever done in my life is my four children. I remember having that thought when they were born. Like, everything else is a bad copy of something else. These are four originals that, you know, nobody can duplicate. So to a certain extent, we're all copying each other. But having said that, absolutely, I think we need to be innovative. For as much flack as The Passion of the Christ got, I thought it was a very compelling movie visually. I thought Mel did a great job directing it. It was described as a moving Caravaggio. So I appreciate that. So I think we can, and you know what? Honestly, there's no excuse. Presumably, you all in this room are people with a direct link to the creator of the universe. That's an advantage that others don't have. So there's really no excuse for us not being creative because you have that energy source to tap into. If we make the effort. Yes, ma'am. Right. So your name? So, Christy, your point is that there isn't a willingness to pay for quality as long as the story is good. I think that's a constant challenge. We're willing to forgive bad art as long as it's in service for a good cause. So as a consumer, you know, you just need to, I would say, put that into practice as a consumer. Say I like the thought behind this one, but I don't like the way it was executed. And I was saying, Brett is a critic, a film critic, and I was encouraging Brett that he can play a role too by writing a review that maybe it does slam them as they deserve to be slammed, but also gives them a way out. One of the problems with Christian music is all the reviewers would always give it 5 stars, like give the CDs 5 stars in the old days. And there was actually a movement to say, if you critique my record, you're critiquing God because God inspired my record. Which I wish I could have used that in school in 4th grade. And they're like, when you give me a C, you're really criticizing my maker because he inspired this paper. But anyway, if we're tougher as consumers, as critics, as a community to say, I love your heart, but the art stinks. Go back, take that same heart, and make a great piece of art. Yes? Yes. Fireproof. It's the same group that made Facing the Giants. So they have a little more money this time. They have $500,000 or $1 million to spend. But it's still a group. It's a church media team who are learning their craft. So what I had suggested for Facing the Giants is that before the film opened, you had the director come on the screen and say, hey, my name is Alex. I made this movie with some buddies of mine. Hope you enjoy it. Because then it would all lower our expectations. Like, we know we're not watching Star Wars. So in that sense, I hope they keep learning their craft, get better and better at it. I've seen it. I don't think it's going to do too well just because they're missing that campaign I was talking about, our PG. People don't know about it. It's not out there. I think it'll come and go pretty quickly. But I hope they'll keep making them and getting better and better. My first essay in like ninth grade was terrible. But I kept writing, you know, and 20 years later, I'm publishable. But I'm glad. So I think it's that process. In 10, 15 years, when they learn their craft more, you know, I'll come back there. Great. That's great news. They're going to be on some major media. My only problem with that is that should have happened about 2 months ago. The media, one thing I learned from The Passion, Mel started a year beforehand. He spent a whole year marketing his film. And what's going to happen with a movie like Fireproof is in about 6 months, my mom will call me up and say, where can I see Fireproof? And I'll be like, Mom, it came out in September, and it's on DVD now. It's just the way she gets her news. She gets an email forwarded from Aunt Helen, who got it from Family Life Today, and this forward bounces around the internet. By the time it gets to her, it's already gone. And so you need to start earlier and get the word out in a different cycle. In a particular genre or... How about Sarah Palin? She's a brand. She's a brand not unlike, I mean, and, you know, I don't know if any of you are charismatics or Pentecostals, but this is about as close as you're going to get to the White House, because John Ashcroft was about the highest charismatic. I don't know if she speaks in tongues or not, but she certainly came from a church that does, and her pastor does. And so, I mean, she's a brand who is not unlike a movie. She did her job. She became mayor of Alaska. She got into a position. It's like, I love pastors who criticize Supreme Court decisions when they don't encourage their people to go to law school. If you don't go to law school and become a lawyer, you have no ability to get into the track that goes to be a Supreme Court justice. So she was governor of Alaska. She got herself into a position where she could at least be considered. And then she did her job. You know, she has an 84% approval rating in Alaska. So to me, she's just a lot like POD. She could have gone into, let's say, explicit Christian ministry. We need those people. I'm not putting down people involved in ministry. But she chose to go into politics. She didn't go into Christian politics. She went into politics. She became a governor, not a Christian governor, and did her job. And then she put herself to a position where God could take her to where she wants to go. I don't know if she'll be elected or not. I don't think God gives guarantees that if you serve him, you get to win the game. But certainly POD is there. I think we're seeing in the artist realm a lot of musicians who are, or you're finding out, are believers. And films, in terms of films, that's a tougher nut to crack because of distribution. But I think in 5 years we'll have a better, as distribution moves to digital, it'll be different, because we can digitally beam films into 2,000 screens for almost no cost, whereas right now it costs $1,000 per print that goes out to all the theaters. Right, digital. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. Yep. Yep. And he has a book out as well. You know, another example is Paste magazine. Paste is a music magazine you all know about, some of you write for. There are Christian guys that started it. It's not Christian Paste magazine. It's just Paste. They review records, good, bad, ugly, whatever. They bring their worldview to bear on it. They just do their job. Do their job excellent, in an excellent way. One more. Are we down to the end? Two more. How about two more? Two more is okay? All right. Two more. The masses don't always do nuance well. Yeah, great. That's the tension of the talk. His question was, do you respond to the interests of the masses at the expense of maybe your own artistic integrity and vision? And it's a great question. If I could answer that in one sentence, I'd be a millionaire. I think you have to be true to yourself and your sense of artistic vision. For myself, for our company, you know, we are hired by different companies to work on different films, and so it's a tension in our office. You know, some of our people are like, "Ooh, I don't want to work on, you know, what Love Comes Softly or whatever." You know, and I'll often fall back on, "Well, you know, Love Comes Softly might be really good for my daughters to watch when they're 7, 8 years old and they're learning about life, and it's not my personal taste." But certainly I can be responsible for the things that I produce, that I write. And I think you... So in my sense, I have the luxury of what I personally create and write versus the things that I might be a part of. So I don't know if that helps you or not, but I think, you know, Paul says to be all things to everyone. And you want to take that and digest it, but not just be that, where you're just moldable to whatever situation you're in, and you'll be this for that and that for that. But I think if you can somehow bring the two together and make excellence, but still make sure that that you're making it for somebody. Because if that consumer doesn't exist, you know, you got a blog for you and your mom and the people that love you. So, right. Yeah. We're talking about Andy Crouch's book, Culture Makers. That really gets into this issue. It's tough and it's complicated, but I think the more, especially we talk, these kinds of talks where we're having this dialogue is great. I think also, as I said, bringing along the creators that you might think are subpar right now, you know, bringing their game up, I think will be really helpful. I had teachers that did that for me. You had professors that did that for you, and we can all be part of that process. Last one, and then I need to finish. Was there one more? I thought I saw one more hand. Before I finish, I wanted to add this one verse. I spoke before the California legislature like 3 months ago, and this has become a weird pattern where I'll wake up in the morning with a verse rolling around in my head the day I'm supposed to speak. So I figure that's God like whacking me that I'm supposed to say something. But 2 Timothy 2:20 and 21 came to mind, and this is a verse that I kind of grew up on. Okay, so you guys are some Seinfeld fans in here. Remember the one where George Costanza stops having sex, which is, you know, probably a good thing, and suddenly he's like a genius. He's like solving puzzles, and because all of his brain power had been wasted on, you know, trying to find the next girl, and all that was unleashed now, and he was finding algorithms and reading dictionaries, and, you know. But 2 Timothy 2:20 and 21 says, in a wealthy home, there are dishes made of gold and silver, as well as some made from wood and clay. The expensive dishes are used for guests, and the cheap ones are used in the kitchen or to put garbage in. If you stay away from sin, you will be like one of these dishes made of pure gold, so that Christ himself can use you for his highest purposes. And I think about that verse, you know, as I'm imagining God is up here and we're all kind of on the floor, and he's trying to decide who he's going to pick and, you know, use, and he's thinking, you know, that Joseph, yeah, he's kind of a dish that I can use for the trash. You know, he just hasn't quite, or I can use him for the gold, you know, or the silver. And I think that there is something to that sexual thing. I think there's so much human power consumed by weird sexual practices and all the things that people can get caught up with on the web in particular, that if we can all get control of our passions and really kind of harness that energy, I think not only will God be able to honor it spiritually, but just in terms of the available energy that we have to us, that's a really powerful verse that I'm reminded of. It's the Living Bible, by the way, so don't, it's not King James, so I might get flack for that, but it's the Living Bible version of that verse, and I hope that all of you, all of us, can be one of those gold or silver dishes. I'd settle for silver, frankly. Silver would be pretty good, so that God can use you on the internet. So, if you have any questions that I didn't answer, you're welcome to ask me after this, and I will scoot out. I wish we'd have more time for Q&A, but that's that.